I'm talking with Rabbi Raphael Kaiser-Bluth again, and he's, of course, from the Masorti Synagogue in St. Albans, and we talked last time at some length about the oral and written Bible and certain aspects of the interpretation, and you drifted in and out of Hebrew quite freely. And I just wondered if you could help me there to understand whether you are completely bilingual, whether the language that you're using is the language used in Israel. Where are we on languages?
Education first. So in point of fact, I'm actually trilingual. I speak Spanish, Hebrew, and English, although English is my mother tongue. My parents are from South America, so we speak Spanish. But Hebrew also is a very integral part of my religious upbringing. It's more than just the religious upbringing. It's the identity, the common factor of Jews all throughout the world. So you will go, and I have traveled to schools and communities in South America, in Australia, in the United States, in Europe. In whatever local language they're speaking, they will all be praying in Hebrew, and some of them will be learning Hebrew. But we need to define what Hebrew actually is, because there are two, maybe three kinds of Hebrew today. There is the biblical Hebrew, the Hebrew that is from the Bible. You have modern Hebrew, which is in essence a modern construction invented about 150 years or so ago. And then you also have a slight variation on Hebrew, which is the Hebrew that's in our prayer books, which is slightly different from the Hebrew in the Torah, the Bible. Now, my education upbringing is I grew up in the States. I went to faith schools there up through primary school. And then secondary school, I went to a state school. But then in university, my degree, I did a double degree. One was at Columbia University, military history, not a lot of need for Hebrew. Perhaps some German with the military terms, I think, but I don't speak German. But my other degree at the seminary where I did my undergraduate degree first was in Talmud, and they have a lot of Hebrew courses. I also lived in Israel twice for a year, and you need to know Hebrew. And the best way to learn a language is to go and be immersed in it. That's how I became fluent in Spanish. I lived in Argentina for a year, and that's how I became fluent in Hebrew. I could read and write Hebrew quite fluently, but speaking is a different proposition. And since I moved to Israel and lived there and spoke it, I was able to learn it quite fluently.
Now, so a child in, I don't want to interrupt, but a child in a Jewish family today would, through the experience of the religious activities at home and in the synagogue, would acquire an understanding of Hebrew. This would be the biblical Hebrew.
It very much depends, and it also depends on what kind of education the parents of the Jewish child would like to give. I'd like to think that there's some kind of familiarity or introduction to Hebrew in most Jewish homes, whether that's reading, being able to recognize it, at least know enough orally to say some of the blessings at home. But most Jewish families connected to some kind of practice will know some rudimentary levels, at least some rudimentary levels of Hebrew. And most often that'll be probably the prayer book Hebrew.
Which would be used particularly on a Friday night.
Friday night for the blessings over the bread, the wine, that kind of thing. Connected to the rituals at home, I think, would be the reason why most people would have some connection to Hebrew. Yes. And again, it's one of those unifying factors. It's one of the reasons why the church clung so long to Latin being the language of the church, because no matter which country you end up spreading to, there's got to be something in practice that unifies you. And for Jews, it's been our prayer, specifically in Hebrew. And for most of us, even to this day, we maintain that.
So the average child who's experienced this prayer-based or prayer book-based, if I can put it correctly, or ritual-based?
I would imagine, yes. I mean, I haven't interviewed all 16 million Jews there are, but I would imagine it would be the connection to the prayer-based Hebrew.
Yeah, and would that Hebrew be sufficient to cope with the Bible, the biblical Hebrew? Or do you need a bit more knowledge?
You would need a little bit more knowledge, because
just trying to clarify.
I would imagine, as with most religious groups, there is a smaller number of people who are quite conversant and in the rituals and the language.
Yes.
The biblical Hebrew is actually quite an older, ancient language that there's still some parts of it that even today some scholars don't quite understand. There are certain terms, and one of the terms, I don't know how I remember this term from my seminary education, hapax legomenon is a term which it's one of those words that stick. But it's a word that only occurs once in the Bible, and we're not certain what it means. Put another way is this was collected and written down 2,000-3,000 years ago, and certain elements of it have been lost. We don't quite understand all of it. Most of it and almost all of it we do, but there are times. So, but just to emphasize, the Bible, the Hebrew in the Bible is not a spoken language anymore. And it's also quite clear that it's evolved and it's different times of Hebrew that are written there. There's some anachronistic use of language, but it's not a spoken language. It's not a spoken language. And it's even not clear that Hebrew at that time was ever a spoken language. There's this idea that it's a Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, and that it should never have been degraded by the mundane, everyday use of speaking. Seems that Jews would have been speaking either Aramaic or Greek. So you look at some of our early legal writings, that's all in Aramaic, which is very related to Hebrew, but it's not Hebrew. It's in the same family as Arabic and Hebrew. Aramaic is what seems like it was a colloquial language.
And does anybody speak Aramaic today?
No. I believe there was a movie, The Passion of the Christ, a couple years ago, actually more than a couple years ago now, that to recreate it, they spoke, the characters learned and spoke Aramaic. But again, like Spanish today or English, there were very many different variations depending on which country you were from. Yeah.
So then 150 years ago, you get the creation of the modern language, Hebrew. So what's the significance of 150 years?
It was the beginning of the rise of the Zionist movement.
Okay, the desire to
the political movement to move and have a homeland. And so
can't have a homeland if you haven't got a language.
Exactly.
Because presumably the diaspora was the Jews spread across, first of all, the Middle East and Europe, and then the world as
well. The world, exactly.
They speak in the local language all the time. So
they either would have been speaking, if they're coming from Europe, their colloquial language would have been Yiddish.
Which, of course, is
German, a little bit of Hebrew, and the variation depending on which country they come from.
And so that becomes a common language. If you're a Jew in the 16th, 17th, 18th century moving around Europe, as you often had to for various reasons, including being chased out of one country into the other, Yiddish would hold you together because that
Yiddish would have been your common language. Yeah, okay. But it wasn't necessarily spoken by everyone, because especially when you have in the 18th century the Enlightenment and the emancipation, the Jews are allowed to now live in the local culture and be accepted fully in the society, you see an incredible drop-off of Yiddish, because they no longer are forced to live in the shtetl, in the ghettos, in their small, closed societies. They are now welcome to live. And so nowadays, Yiddish is a dying language. Except in pockets of the insular Jews, Yiddish is just not really spoken anymore. I would imagine my ancestors 300-400 years ago probably would have been speaking Yiddish. Nowadays, in my family, no one even, we know a couple, I mean, there's some words that have entered into the vernacular, Shlemiel and Oyvei and Mazel and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But in general, it's not really a spoken language. And the Sephardi Jews in North Africa and the Middle East, they had their own vernacular called Ladino, which is based on Spanish, because many of them came from the expulsion from Spain 500 years ago. But again, and colored with bits and pieces of the local language. But again, that language is dying because Jews have been absorbed into the local cultures. And so about 150, a little bit more than 150 years ago, a gentleman by the name of Eliezer ben Yehuda decided that if we're going to be moving into a country, we need something that's going to bind us all together, and that has to be the language that we speak.
Now, he was in Europe somewhere.
I believe Lithuania. I apologize. I don't remember exactly, but
Lithuania was part of Poland at the time.
Exactly. Depending on which year and where the border happens to be, so somewhere in there. If it was owned by Poland, by Russia, by Germany, by Prussia,
that's right.
Take your pick. Yeah. But he emigrated to Israel, and he decided that they needed to speak a common language. And the beauty of modern Hebrew is that it's a very, very new language, very rational, very structured, not encumbered by the years of evolution of other languages. And the problem was no one spoke it. So he spoke to his son only in Hebrew, to the point that his son didn't speak any other language except Hebrew. Which sounds great, except you realize that this is a language that has just been invented. Who else is going to speak it? Who else can he communicate with? And so the contributions of Eliezer ben Yehuda were not really recognized until as most people, after his death. But the language now spoken in Israel is Hebrew. But again, don't confuse that with Hebrew from the Bible. Mm. It's not the same language. It's very, very similar. Mm. It's based on it, but it's not the same language.
So anybody who's emigrated to Israel over the last 100-150 years will learn that as part of the process of
exactly right. And it's actually a process. When you make what's called Aliyah, when you move to Israel, requirement is that you spend weeks or months in an absorption center learning Hebrew. That's the first thing you do before you move out into the rest of the culture. You are required to learn Hebrew, because otherwise, how are you going to learn and function in that society? Now, obviously, there are many people who speak a variety of different languages. You can probably get by on English in certain places, in the major cities, but Hebrew is invaluable. You can't really function for very long in Israel without knowing it.
Okay. In this series, we're making certain that we don't get into the political arena in any sense, because it's far too complex. That's not what we want to do. What we want to do is understand the religions, the three religions.
Yes.
But one of the questions that arises, and it sort of comes in different ways, what is the significance of Israel to a Jew?
The significance of Israel is it's their spiritual homeland. A Jew cannot exist without the idea of Israel.
Could it remain just an idea?
But it's more than just an idea. It's the longing for that we have. It's the place where we all pray towards. It's the place where our hearts and our souls are aimed to. When we pray, we're always praying towards Israel. And when you're in Israel,
physically.
Yeah. And when you are in Israel, you pray towards Jerusalem. And when you're in Jerusalem, you pray towards the Temple Mount. And when you're on the Temple Mount, you pray towards the Holy of Holies, that central place. Mm. It's this idea that it's much more than just simply an idea. It's the centrality of our people, mm-hmm. the place where we call home, both physically and spiritually.
And the great burst of growth, of course, came after the Holocaust, the Second World War, when there had been a clamoring for somewhere.
A return to. I mean, there had been Jewish settlement there from the times of the Bible. Yeah. And there actually had been a continuous Jewish presence there, but under various different empires and dominions.
Sure.
You know, the Turkish, the British, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Persians, you name it. It's just a very strategic piece of land. It's this idea of needing to return home, needing to go back to the place of our ancestors, mm-hmm. needing to go back to that place where God revealed God's self to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to the Jewish people, a place where two temples stood. You're talking 3,000 or 4,000 uninterrupted years of history, of connection. And so it's much more than just a physical place. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual homeland as well. And so it's not just an idea. It's actually a physical reality that is a connection between us as people and with our souls. And it's you can't really separate that from the idea of Judaism, much like you can't separate Mecca from a Muslim or Rome from a Catholic. Mm. It is the homeland of where we are. And so I can continue to function as a Jew, not necessarily being in Israel, with a longing for returning there, but I couldn't function without. I couldn't be a Jew. That's one of the main pillars of who I am as a Jew.
Mm-hmm. There are different types of Jews, aren't there? There's a spectrum within Judaism, as there is within Christianity, but also Islam.
In any faith, when you have, or in any group, or any ideology, when you have people, you're going to have different interpretations. Any idea, whether it be a political ideology, a religious ideology, an educational ideology, anything, when people get involved, there's an evolution and a difference of interpretation of how it evolves.
And within Judaism,
Orthodox
to the very liberal.
Exactly,
so
right.
Run us over that.
So you have, in essence, three major divisions in Judaism at the moment. There's smaller groups, absolutely, but you have, up until about 300 or so years ago, the emancipation time, you had really this definition or distinction between religious Jews and secular Jews.
Just go back to emancipation when you talk.
That is the Enlightenment period.
Which was also the time that Jews began to be allowed to own land.
Exactly
and
right.
Stay
and
in one
so
place
you and have this idea now that either you were religious or not, then, and I'm grossly simplifying this, obviously, but you then start to have a clamoring for Jews who want to be accepted. And I don't want to be marked as different because I don't have to anymore. Yes, I want to be, and it's a basic human need. I want to be accepted.
Yes. I can be a German who's also a Jew.
Exactly right. German, and so German, you start to see quite drastic changes in Jewish practice. Some quite extreme that were forgotten and let go, but that was the rise of the Reform Movement, which was the first movement attempt to reform Judaism. That's where the name comes from, Reform Judaism. They moved, in some extreme cases, Shabbat to Sunday to be like everybody else. Some of the ritual practices that marked us as different, such as keeping kosher or the strict observance of Shabbat, were lessened. And there was an idea that Judaism, the giving of the Bible, was not necessarily the actual word of God. These were stories and the best understanding of us to interpret by human beings to continue our tradition. But it's not necessarily divinely, literally given by God to man. It was a collection of stories over time that, because they were written and down and passed on by humans, we have the same power to interpret and change them. And so the values and the ethics are very, very important. But the laws, because they're not necessarily divinely inspired, become less so. And so there's more of an opportunity to change things. Some of the changes that they've instituted have become adopted by almost everybody, such as the sermon by the rabbi giving in the vernacular. Whereas before, it had always been given in Aramaic or Hebrew. Now, you go to any synagogue, anywhere in the world, of any movement, will be in the vernacular. If I'm here, it's in English. If I'm in South America, it's in Spanish. In Israel, it's in Hebrew. In Germany, it's in German, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But that was a major, major change that was fought tooth and nail by many people. Music they introduced into their worship services. They also changed the structure of what the actual building looked like. And in Europe, it began to resemble that of the church, where the clergy were up in front, because before, they would have sat in the middle, all facing the same direction. So quite significant changes. The Orthodox arises out of that as a rejection, as a counterpoint to the Reform Movement, that they are worried, as human nature is, of change. You look at many different, or almost every conflict in human history, it's can be usually boiled down to how much do we change and how fast do we change it. And their response was, you're changing too much too quickly. We are no longer going to change anything, and things are going to become static as they are, which is an exaggeration, but it's the fear of change. Mm. And so you start to have a stagnation of Jewish development in the Orthodox,
which becomes difficult. Something you were talking about once before, when the interpretation in the light of modern experience,
correct,
it becomes very difficult for an ultra or extremely Orthodox person, right, to adapt to the changes
because
in the
society. Because they are so worried about change that they see the extreme change of the early Reform Movement that is a rejection of this uninterrupted chain. And so those are the two major threads of Judaism until the conservative movement emerges. Now, it emerges in two different places for different reasons. In the United States, a conservative movement evolved in the latter half of the 19th century as a rejection of the Reform Movement because they've gone too far, where they really, as an official position, begin to reject the laws of keeping kosher, certain rituals of observing Shabbat. And so there is an attempt to move back into a more traditional or conservative, as the name implies, practice that embodies the drive of the Reform to be accepted, to live in a modern time, but also embracing the Orthodox in that we are based in a link of tradition that goes back thousands of years, and we have to straddle those two. So it very much becomes, in certain ways, a middle ground. It has its legs in both sides, acknowledging I am part of a beautiful, rich history and tradition, but also that I'm moving and living in a modern time. So we are moving forward, yet understanding and accepting that I am part of a tradition. And that's the movement that I am a part of. In Europe, you have the rejection of the Orthodox as becoming too extreme, too stratified, too stagnant, and needing to embrace a modern approach to certain things. And so here in Europe, it's the Masorti tradition, which is the tradition, as it means, of passing on. And so they move away from the Orthodox and come to the center. And so initially, both of these movements were separate, but they've come to the same place for different reasons, but now occupy the same space. And there is an understanding that it is one movement now.
Great. We've run out of time again. We'll talk more about some of the practices as well, I think, in future sessions. Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.